From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Our connection for this hour is made in Lawrence, Kansas. That's the home of Haskell Indian Nations University, where Dr. Daniel Wildcat teaches about American Indian studies. Wildcat has become a leading voice in the movement to bring an American Indian sensibility to how we approach climate change. His book is called Red Alert: Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge. It starts with outlining a basic difference between indigenous people and non-indigenous people. Wildcat explains in his book that our society tends to look at nature as resources, just tools for our disposal. American Indians tend to look at nature as relatives, and that requires a different approach. This week, Wildcat is guest lecturing at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and on Thursday night he'll be delivering an address. But first, he joins us on Connections. Dr. Daniel Wildcat, nice to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Well, let's start with this here. We want to learn a little bit about your background. So you come to us this week from Lawrence, Kansas. Tell us about your background in studies and research.
First of all, again, thanks for having me on your program. My home institution is Haskell Indian Nations University. It has a long and storied history. It was one of the early off-reservation boarding schools that was created to solve the Indian problem in the 19th century. It opened its doors in 1884 as the United States Indian Industrial Training School, and has evolved from being an institution wholeheartedly committed to, as in the immortal words of Richard Henry Pratt, the architect of the Indian boarding school, said, to kill the Indian to save the man. Kind of a chilling statement if you think about it, but the idea that it was one's Senecaness, one's Onondagueness, one's Lakotaness, one's Apacheness, one's Muscogee, one's Yucheness that really was the obstacle to those boys and girls, young people, becoming fully intelligent and functioning civilized human beings. And Haskell was a part of that history, and now we've evolved in the last century and more than a century now to become an institution that affirms and honors and teaches and studies and conducts research based on our own indigenous intellectual traditions, our own indigenous values and beliefs. So I think probably Richard, it hasn't turned out quite the way Richard Henry Pratt probably designed, but it's an honor to be here in the homeland of the Seneca peoples and the center of their homeland here next to Seneca Lake. So, it's great to be here. My research for the last, I've been at Haskell now almost three decades, and my research really for the last decade and a half has really revolved around climate change and its impacts on Native peoples.
And we're going to be talking about that throughout the hour. And in fact, if you want to join the conversation, 263-WXXI, 263-9994, and 585-263-9994. Now, Dr. Wildcat, I'm reading that you are a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation of Oklahoma. And if I were, I always try to be an eminently prepared host, but one thing I am not prepared to do is give you a native greeting. Can you give us a greeting?
I would say Songeli, Gelasan, Zoyaha, Yuchiha, Muscogee. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm a Muscogee, a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation. Yeah.
Very good. Well, it's nice to have you here, and I know you're going to be you're guest lecturing this week at Hobart and William Smith Colleges before the presentation on Thursday night, and we're going to be telling you our listeners about that as we go throughout the hour here. But let's start here. You've spent a lot of time over the last decade or so, from what I've read and seen of your lectures, dealing with the debate that doesn't seem to be much debate anymore. 97% of scientists agree that climate change is happening and likely man-caused, et cetera. So do we at least agree? Can we set a premise that there is something happening and changing in our atmosphere and we can move forward from there?
Well, I'd like to believe so. Of course, we still have very prominent people in the media who would like to, pretend or present this as some sort of debatable issue. What I've always felt like all along, and talk about this in my book, is that, if if people would listen to Native peoples who have long-standing, intergenerational, hundreds of years, thousands of years, interaction with particular landscapes and seascapes on the planet, these are folks who are reporting changes where their baselines of observation based on this intergenerational tradition of passing on knowledge and stories and events of past history, they're seeing changes. And I tell you what, they don't have to tune in to CNN or NBC or, you know, CSNBC or any kind of media outlet to be convinced or read a book about climate change. They're living it. They see it. If you're in the Northwest Coast, it's affecting the salmon. If you're in the Arctic, it's affecting your entire way of life. With the disappearance, as Oscar Quagley says so poignantly in an essay he wrote, the cold is leaving. You see it in the desert Southwest, where we're entering a second decade of extended drought. And for some of that is carried over now. We're seeing the horrible drought conditions in that very rich farming area of Central California. And the extreme weather events of the last year, I think the kinds of storms that we see now tracking out of Texas and then south and then up across the mid-Atlantic coast have really gotten people's attention. Hurricane Sandy, no real precedent for a storm like that at that time of year. These are pieces of evidence that suggest these extreme weather events are evidence of the climate changing. I agree with you. The main obstacle we have is the way people live today. They can live their lives, for the most part, very inattentively to the climate around them, to the life around them. That's a challenge, I think, for people like that who aren't paying attention, who think of water as something that comes out of a tap and food that comes out of a nice cellophane wrapped piece of meat in the meat that the grocers and vegetables come out of a can. It's easy to not pay attention, and that's one of the challenges we face. That's why we need to listen to Native people who are paying attention and continue to, in very practical ways, interact with the natural world around them.
Yeah, and you write in your book, Red Alert, about that difference among Native and maybe non-Native people who, as you say, view nature as just a resource to use, as mm-hmm. opposed to the Native view that it is a relative to treat with respect. Does that oversimplify it, or is that a fair description in your view?
Well, again, you've got to be real careful of universal declarations. There's probably, American Indians represent such cultural diversity that, as a general statement, I'd say, one of the advantages I have being at Haskell Indian Nations University, which has a very rich, long intertribal history of people from many nations attending, I've been able to kind of compare notes, and look for common denominators. And I would say, as a general statement, not a universal statement, I think this notion that in many indigenous worldviews, tribal worldviews, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Cherokees or Onondagas or Passamaquoddies or Apaches or Lummies, this notion that we extend the idea of, as it were, even personhood to other life forms around us is a very significant distinction, because it basically suggests that, the world and our construction of our moral and political universe is not just a human one. It's one that includes the plants and the animals we share the planet with, and but for their existence, our existence would be impossible too. And so we extend and understand, we're given this knowledge that these are indeed relatives, not resources, which then sets up that whole different kind of nature of interaction, whereas I tell people, it's easy to use to extract to exploit resources. But I tell you what, you don't deal like that with your aunts and uncles and your grandparents. If you do, at least in my family, you're going to get put in your place very quickly.
We're talking to Dr. Daniel Wildcat.
Extend respect.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Daniel Wildcat, who is a professor from Lawrence, Kansas, the home of Haskell Indian Nations University, where he teaches about American Indian Studies. He's been focusing his research and work on climate change for many years now. His book is called Red Alert, Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge, and he's going to talk at 8 p.m. in the Albright Auditorium on Thursday night at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. The talk is called Enacting Indigenuity in an Age of Global Environmental Crisis. I like the turn on the words there, Dr. Wildcat, and he's also speaking to classes at Hobart and William Smith this week. So if you want to join the conversation, 263-WXXM, 263-9994. Now, in your book, you describe it not as global warming, but global burning. And
yes.
you're tough on the notion of fossil fuels, as you say, our use of them. And so let me ask you, do you want to see us no longer use fossil fuels for energy? And what kind of energy future would you like to see?
Well, that's a complex question. Of course, the simple answer is, of course, I'd love to see us wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. But I think if you're going to be realistic and practical in any sense, and you look at the kind of transportation, the kind of energy systems and infrastructure we have in place, we have deep investment, deep sunk cost into an energy system, a grid, highways, transportation, that is all built on this notion of, you know, the use of carbon energy. And so you've got to be realistic about that. I think the point is to say that, you know, every opportunity we have to put to use non-carbon-based, you know, energy, whether that's geothermal, whether that's wind, whether that's solar, even explorations of sort of tidal energy. I know there are a lot of questions that are unresolved about that, that we should look at that. I do have a few colleagues, I'm not completely on board with them, though, that are arguing, like some prominent environmentalists, that it may be time to relook at nuclear. I'm not ready to go there yet, but I certainly think we need to have a conversation, an informed, intelligent conversation about that, because, as you know, we've quit building nuclear plants in the U.S. and in Europe. Most of the electrical energy is provided from nuclear fuel, particularly in France. And so they've been building them. They've been continuing to improve them. That's what I'm told. They haven't had any, you know, major accidents in Europe yet. And so I'm open to all discussions that will ask us to very critically examine what our energy future looks like. Although we're producing more carbon energy than we ever have, all that means is we're using it up much more quickly, mm-hmm. and we need to really start thinking about the future. That's the challenge.
We are we're right in the heart of a region that is debating hydrofracking, the extraction of natural mm-hmm. gas from the shale mm-hmm. below the surface, and very interesting that in the Finger Lakes and in our region, I've talked to professors at Cornell, Hobart, William Smith, limnologists, different scientists, and some of them have offered grave concerns. I also spoke to a geologist from Syracuse University who says we must get off coal and oil, and natural gas is a very good next step to help us do that. And so we've got to be open to that, even if it's not perfect. I wonder how much you've taken a look at fracking.
I've taken a look at it quite a bit because, you know, in the Central Plains, fracking is underway, and particularly even in Oklahoma, hydrofracking is very a very common practice.
Yeah.
I think I am very hesitant to go down that road, and let me tell you why. I want to be very clear about why I think this is dangerous. I think it's dangerous because you know, the water that is treated with chemicals to go in there to create, you know, the chemical processes to release these gases and everything. This is, that water is not recapturable or reusable. What's its relationship to the water tables, the freshwater tables we depend on? I think there are a number of very serious questions we have to look at and answer. And I think one of the issues that, you know, continually sort of comes up, and we're facing it in this debate. So I agree, coal, absolutely. You know, we got to get off coal. We can't burn coal anymore. Yes, I agree with the professor, the geologist, that, you know, it looks like, you know, this hydrofracking and fracking would be a way to, you know, get renewable to get carbon-based energy that would be less harmful. But I think that's a great assumption, because one of the things that we know, and an unwarranted assumption at this point, in my mind, and that's simply because we don't know what this kind of activity and also the high use of water that's going to become one of the most precious resources in the next decade.
As California knows.
Yeah. It's going to be, you know, in one way or another, the shorthand version of climate change, and this is why I'm opposed to fracking at this point in time. I'm opposed to it because in one way or another, this next century on this planet is going to be about the water. Some people are going to have a lot more of it than they ever wanted or could usefully, you know, build a practical living relationship with, and some people are going to have a lot less of it. And so it's all about water. And given the amount of water that gets used in these processes, I think it's too precious to use in this way.
We're talking to Dr. Daniel Wildcat, who is at Hobart and William Smith this week. He's visiting this week in our area. He comes from Lawrence, Kansas, the home of Haskell Indian Nations University, where he teaches. And Anthony is on the line. Anthony, thanks for calling Connections.
Say good morning. With all due respect to the doctor and to his Indian heritage, I would have a sort of fundamental question, at least in my mind, as to why he would think that Indian traditions, which he said go back thousands of years, the Indians, for all their goodness, were pre-industrial folks. They didn't live in cities of millions. They didn't travel around, et cetera, et cetera. Why would he think that there's some insight that Indian culture, you know, could bring to the present dilemmas we have over energy use?
Thanks for calling, Anthony. Go ahead, Dr. Welch. Yeah.
Anthony, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I think the answer is threefold. First is, we're talking about principles of living. And I think one of the things that we've missed in the headlong movement towards industrialization and this road towards progress and this kind of notion that we can technologically transform and control nature is that is basically a false premise. We're not in charge. Humans have a great impact on the planet, but it is much larger and populated by many more forms of life than just human life. I think native people, and maybe it was because of the kind of low-level technology that they employed, understood the value of making sure that you didn't think of the land, the air, and the water, and the plants of animals as resources, but you thought of how do I establish a relationship that is sustainable and allows our communities and our peoples to live well in particular places on the planet. That's a principle. I think it's a very applicable principle. I think it's one we need to employ today, right now. I'm not saying it's easy, but it could be done. The second point I would make is because, as it were, as I talk in my book, our cultures, our technologies, our tools, our ceremonies, our languages, our houses, our clothing, our diets were shaped out of these relationships with very particular landscapes and seascapes. We had the recognition that to live well, we had to maintain those relationships. We had to, you know, build diets around what was there and maintaining a relationship with that. We had to build homes in a way that fit the climate, the weather, the materials that were at hand. So this is something that's now is not radical at all. I mean, in some ways, the whole sort of appropriate technology debate about how we need to look at what technology is appropriate for what particular environment, I'd say that's not new to Native people. They've known this for thousands of years and have employed it well. So I think that's something that, again, this sort of notion of thinking that avoiding the idea that there's one best way to live or solve our problems, Native people give you the insight to appreciate that how you live, the kind of home you're going to build, ought to be custom designed to fit that landscape. If I were living in Syracuse, New York, I would build a very different home than if I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. The crime today is that we have such lack of imagination that people build the same boxes in both places and live in them. Why? We ought to have architecture design that fits places. The final point, the third point, and I think this is something that is of keen practical importance, and that would be that I think what indigenous traditions can an informed study of those, and I've been fortunate to be in classes here at Hobart William Smith College where people are talking about these things. But I think the third point is that we humankind has lived in such a way today that we're no longer paying attention to the world around us. We don't have to. We've built environments where we live in, as it were, what I would describe as insulated ignorance. And
what's an example of that?
Consider our lives. You started the morning in a box. You got in a box and four wheels. You ran probably as quickly as you could from the car into another box. Where are you going after work?
Probably to another box.
Back to another box. I think that, the reason that people think in boxes today is they spend all their time in boxes. I think what we should do is we should do a radical experiment of, taking children outside again. And maybe we can address what some people are calling nature deficit disorder. I don't think there's anything romantic about that. I think it's of the utmost practical importance, and I think Native traditions show us that.
Yeah, I think Anthony Stillon, I'm going to bring him back in just a second, but let me ask you as a follow-up here, Dr. Wildcat, based on that, Anthony was asking about the notion that indigenous people live in sort of a pre-industrial world. You're not advocating a return to a fully pre-industrial world.
Absolutely not. And thank you for doing the follow-up. And this is probably a question Anthony's been formulating too, but not at all. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not anti-technology. If anything, I'm advocating that technology be the value of technology be recalibrated. We ought to look at technology as employed in some way that is enhancing of human community, human cultures. In other words, does it allow the diversity of cultures that are based on the diversity of landscapes and seascapes environments humans have evolved in? And ultimately, does it enhance our communication so that we can strengthen cultures and communities? And I think if you look at the way technology is employed today, that sometimes communities, sometimes cultures, are completely left out. We do seem to be fixated on a notion of communication, but the only thing I will say about that is I think, unfortunately, even Marshall McLuhan was a little bit shocked with how quickly communication technologies could be used in ways that were not always serving education and furthering the intelligence of humankind.
All right, let's see if Anthony wants to follow up at all. Anthony, what do you think?
The professor is making very excellent insights here. I would only caution, however, that even Western civilization has ancient origins. We, until a few centuries ago, were essentially living by sunlight, sunset. We were prone to every illness out there, and many other issues. So we didn't exactly drop on this earth from some landing craft of another planet. We have also evolved from, you know, primitive origins in the 15th century that were basically the same as the Romans. So Western society, I mean, has also got a huge storehouse of past, you know, information and experiences. So I think it's a little broad to say that we're somehow these techno-robots that don't relate to the land and the water, etc. I mean, obviously, we're living in urban settings. We don't have to get up at sunset or go to bed at the other way around, actually, sunrise, sunset. But people are not that lame, to use my own phrase, and I don't mean to impugn anything you've said. But I think to narrow your focus on the Indian American, North American Indians' contributions to what we can learn today is a little out of balance, okay? I mean, Westerners are not like some kind of effete, don't know about anything, just enjoy themselves. And, you know, we come from a deep tradition of frugality that right up to this century, farmers would save everything they had, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my only thing, just perhaps a difference of focus and what you're bringing. And I know this is your area, and I don't impugn your motives and what you know about, you know, Indian life, etc. But I think it's a little broad brush to say that there's something so different and so deeply knowledgeable from the Indian tradition that it's lacking elsewhere. Well, so that's all. I don't want to give you any more pause to consider my comments.
No. Hey, Anthony, thank you for calling, and that's part of the discussion. I know
absolutely.
Dr. Wildcat welcomes that. So, Anthony, thanks for the call.
Oh, absolutely.
Why don't we're late for a break, Dr. Wildcat, but why don't you put a quick final point on Anthony's
okay,
thoughts?
Okay, I do, and I want to thank Anthony for his comments. Anthony, what we would need to do is we'd need to have, you know, some coffee, maybe some good food, and have a very long discussion about the points you're raising. I'll give you three quick things that just to sort of wrap your mind around. So show me in the major institutions of the United States, our education institution. Show me in the major religious denominations. Show me in the financial, particularly the financial institutions. Show me in the major institutions of the United States where we have acknowledgement of a recognition of the contributions of Native Americans. Well, we can look at the United States government. There's been some research done on that, but even when you look at that, it's interesting what was left out, what was borrowed, and yet what was left out from the Haudenosaunee, those nations here of now New York State, the so-called Iroquoian Confederacy. All I would say is that, you know, the institutions we move through are very informed by the Western tradition. Second, you do have a tribal heritage. I think it's unfortunate that most Europeans don't know their tribal heritage. Your ancestors and my ancestors were both members of tribes for much longer than they were citizens of modern nation states. Maybe it's time to have a serious re-examination of European tribalism. That might be really interesting. And last but not least, yes, this is a book that is meant to speak to people, but again, it maybe in your words, it's an overstatement. I don't think it is, but it's definitely affirming something that seems to lack positive affirmation and acknowledgement today. And I appreciate your calls and your comments and questions. Thank you, Anthony.
And Dr. Wildcat, you know, I saw a theme the other day. I've got a 2-year-old son, and I think about him getting outside. I was a camp counselor down in Chautauqua Lake, and Chief Running Water used to arrive every Sunday night and tell us about the Indian traditions. I was raised in they called them villages at the camp, and I was in the Onondagas and the Cayugas, then the Senecas. We taught the Tuscaroras, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, but a lot of people are not raised with any sort of an education on that. And at the very basic level, the point that you make that resonates with me as a father now is getting outside and getting away from the boxes. I saw a meme going around the internet the other day, and someone said, "I heard of a new social network. It's called Outside." It used to be.
I love it.
It used to be where we spent a lot of time in social networks. So
exactly. So
I'm with you on that. Let's take a short break. If you're waiting on the phone to talk to Dr. Daniel Wildcat, we'll get to you next. He will speak at 8 p.m. Thursday night in the Albright Auditorium down in Hobart and William Smith. He's a guest lecturer this week. He's the author of a book called Red Alert, Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge, and he's on Connections for the Hour. Short break on member-supported public radio.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Rivers Run, a senior living community and the site of RIT's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, offering independent and enriched living with concierge and assistive services. Rivers Run, learn, live, grow. RiversRunLiving.com.
And welcome back to Connections on this Tuesday afternoon. Dr. Daniel Wildcat is talking to us this afternoon about what we can learn from American Indians and their approach, the approach of Indigenous people to the issue of climate change. Bernard has been waiting to talk to Dr. Wildcat. Go ahead, Bernard.
Thank you. I wonder if Anthony can actually prove we weren't dropped here on a spaceship. Native Americans, it seems to me one of the elements that this brings forth is kind of this fact that America doesn't realize, or we don't seem to realize, that we will isolate people, populations that don't, if you will, fit our scheme. And we won't be nice about it, in my opinion. And that's just my opinion. I don't have the good knowledge about it. So it seems to me that one of the things we need to be concerned about is if you take the example of how we've treated the American Native in America, we need to be concerned about how, if you will, the industrial people will treat us when there are problems with what their manufacturing environment does. So, for example, the coal industry will pollute the land because it only affects one class of people. So I think as, in addition to the science, there's also a sense of poor humanity on this whole topic, and I'd appreciate your comments on that. Thanks very much for the show.
Bernard, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dr. Wildcat.
Yeah, Bernard, thank you for that question. I mean, we could do a whole program on that. At the way you framed it, it's has several levels, but the first level I think of immediately is sort of the whole issue of environmental justice in this country. I mean, when we look at where, you know, the most extractive activities are going on, when we look at refining, when we look at kind of the unpleasant things that our society depends on, the rule of thumb is NIMBY, not in my backyard. And, you know, so people who are perfectly, you know, nonchalant about, you know, refining oil or natural gas transmission and those kinds of things, boy, suggest you're going to put that next to their golf course or country club. And I guess you'll find out all of a sudden that that's not something they're really in favor of. I think, you know, there's an incredible environmental justice dimension to this. And to clarify something, to, again, to add to the question you've added as a way of responding, Bernard, I think that when I talk about indigenous peoples, I wrote my book based on my experience in North America, but I'm extending that to native peoples, tribal peoples all over the planet. I think there's tremendous knowledge there. But this idea that we have in American society, a low tolerance for diversity and people who think differently. I think probably, sadly, American Indians would be, you know, one of the people, indigenous peoples of, you know, that now's homelands reside within the political boundaries or located within the political boundaries of the United States, contiguous 48 states, Alaska, and the island of Hawaii, would all point out that, you know, whole institutions, I talked about this earlier today, boarding school institutions were created in the chilling words of Richard Henry Pratt to, you know, kill the Indian to save the man. And what does that tell you? That, you know, it was our nativeness that was the very obstacle, because we didn't see the world the way, you know, the settlers and the colonizing peoples of the United States did. So, you know, we were a problem. We were denominated in the 19th century U.S. history, the Indian problem. And so I think this really does sort of reinforce, well, it certainly supports a concern that we should have just how open are we to diversity of opinion. It always strikes me as interesting that it took a European visiting the United States, and I'd ask everyone to take a close look at de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. As he stated very succinctly, the greatest problem he saw is he had never seen a people who so widely proclaimed, you know, the diversity of opinion and had so little of it. And in the closing parts of his book has some very chilling remarks about the nature of how this love and precondition for democracy, this freedom of thought, freedom of expression, might in fact be threatened, not by, you know, an overweening exercise of power, but by what he called the tyrannical majority.
Talking to Dr. Daniel Wildcat, who is speaking in our area this week. He's at Hobart and William Smith Colleges as a guest professor from Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, where he is a scholar who's written on indigenous knowledge, technology, the environment, education, and other issues. Online on Twitter, Maria writes, Dr. Wildcat, Maria writes, I'm liking the ideas I'm hearing. What's a tangible change in daily behavior that he would advocate? Daily behavior, more than just accepting maybe societal ideas, but are there daily things that you think could come up on the issue of climate change?
Walk. W-A-L-K. Walk. Make it a part of your day to walk, clear your mind, and, you know, the Aborigines of Australia talk about something called a walkabout. You have to really know your place and know who you are, and they conduct walkabouts. I think we need walkabouts.
Oh, but we don't have people. Enough time, Dr. Wildcat. We're all so
busy.
And I've been there myself. I'm not belittling. I've said it every day.
No. But here's the deal, okay? And I'm going to give you a very concrete. I'm one of these guys who's I'm very much a part of the modern world. I'm living in it. I'm you know, don't people romanticize Dan Wildcat's existence. I'm plugged in to my computer, my iPad, and my cell phone's going off. I probably have a dozen calls when I get off this call. But I tell you what, I'm thankful that I have, and again, this is practical, but I'm going to tell you how much I've benefited. I have two hounds. I have two beagles, and they insist I take them. I can't live with them. I don't take them on walks. They will badger me. They will not let me rest. And I am so thankful. Sometimes we'll walk before the sun goes down. Sometimes we'll take walk after the sun goes down. But when I get out with those dogs and I walk, and I'm walking around an urban neighborhood, it's amazing what I hear and what I see. And things that I think give me some concerns about my immediate residence that I wouldn't have if I weren't taking those walks. I think that's practical. I think it's informative, also has some health benefits. What the heck? You know, so I think these are little things that we do that can inform even our activism. So I've started getting very engaged in my neighborhood community, neighborhood association, because I've got some issues I'd like to see addressed.
Well, and if I could just jump in and say that sometimes I wonder, you know, if our ego gets in the way, mine as well, when I say that we have really good intentions. I'm somebody who I'd love to, before I'm gone from this planet, leave it a better place, make an impact, touch as many people as possible, make people happier, healthier, et cetera. And I think those are noble goals, but sometimes does that cause us to fill up our schedule to the absolute last drop and not leave this time for reflection and contemplation?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I think it does. I mean, I think, you know, myself, I was talking to students earlier that, you know, I think one of the admirable things that we need to try to inculcate is a sense of humility, a sense that, you know, it's not all about us, but it at the same time, You know, we have to be strong. We have to be committed. So my new formulation I've been playing with kind of goes like this. We need to move from a world that's preoccupied with resources to one where we begin to value relatives. We need to move from a society that's totally preoccupied with inalienable individual rights to one that can counterbalance that with something that is deeply a part of many Native traditions, and that is the acknowledgement of inalienable responsibilities we have as relatives. And last but not least, that we might be very critical today of discussions about, quote, sustainability, because now it seems like everyone on the planet is in favor of sustainability. What exactly do they want to sustain? I would suggest, when people say you're anti-progress, I would suggest, no, I'm not so much anti-progress as I am. What I am in favor of is finding out ways that we can enact, that we can create systems of life enhancement. The problem with the idea of progress is it's a very anthropocentric measure. It's all about us. It's about our tools. It's about what we think we can control. I think an indigenous counterpoint would be to say, one kind of counterpoint would say, well, no, it's not all about us. In fact, once you realize that, once you become a good relative, you behave responsibly, we start looking at ways to employ technology to create things that will be life enhancing as opposed to life destroying.
Let's get back to the phones. Tim in Rochester, you're on with Dr. Daniel Wildcat. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Wildcat for talking and for lecturing at Hobart. I'm involved in a local organization called the Citizens Climate Lobby, and we're very concerned about climate change and global warming, and we're particularly interested in solutions on a national scale, on a policy scale. So, first of all, obviously, President Obama has generated some proposals for regulatory reform regarding the coal industry and future coal power plants. We're especially interested in a market-based legislative proposal that is a revenue-neutral carbon fee and dividend that would basically place a cost onto the fossil fuels as sources of CO2 and warming of the atmosphere, in a way that would send a price signal to the market to A, become more efficient, and B, begin to invest much more in to attract capital to expanding investment in alternative energies on a much deeper and more radical scale. So the whole idea of putting a price on carbon, I'd like to get Professor Wildcat's thoughts and opinions on that kind of level of policy response that is, it's potential.
Yeah, good question. Thanks, yes. Tim. Thanks for calling. Go ahead, Dr. Wildcat.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Okay, let's talk about the big picture, the systemic reforms. I think those employment of market-based strategies will be crucial. I mean, in terms of what we can do in a regulatory manner, what we can do in terms of passing laws, I think putting a price on that is a cost. Is very important. One of the things I've played around with and thought in terms of, what would be other things you could do. I've thought of, things like, having a sort of an environmental surcharge on vehicles. We've built a society where, unfortunately, most of the towns and the way we live and where we live requires that people have an automobile. Unless they're in a very large urban area with a very good mass transit system, the island of Manhattan might be a good example of that, where it's actually not very advantageous to have an automobile. But for many of us, where we live, I mean, just getting to school, to work, our kids to where they need to go, to doing our basic food shopping, our grocery shopping, you get in a car. It'd be dangerous in many places to try to walk there even. So I've thought that one of the things we should explore is sort of like an environmental surcharge on vehicles. I would look at, you know, some way to tell people, okay, you're going to drive that great big old SUV, you're going to drive that Suburban, you're going to have right off the top a $2,500 or $3,000 surcharge. That goes directly into an, you know, renewable energy fund. You can drive something a little more modest, but still not very good gas mileage, put a surcharge on it. It's not the 3,000, now you're down to 2,000. And you finally get to a point to where those cars, those manufacturers that are really building the fuel efficient, you know, the hybrid kind of automobiles that we're looking at, and we're giving some incentive to people to buy those, consumers to buy those, you know, the surcharge is zero. I mean, I think those are market-based kinds of ideas that I think are really important for us to explore. So I like those ideas, and maybe if you come to my talk Thursday night, we can talk more about that.
Thursday night, 8 p.m. in the Albright Auditorium. We're starting to run up against the clock, but I wanted to ask you, Dr. Wildcat, about you're in the plains, you're in Kansas, and big mm-hmm. agricultural part of America. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago that the U.S. government was pushing corn-based ethanol, and I have learned about, the Seneca Indians talk mm-hmm. about Diohaco, which is the three sisters. They talk about corn, mm-hmm. beans, and squash growing together and providing mm-hmm. that relationship. But what we learned when corn-based ethanol hit was that farmers were, instead of rotating crops and letting those things work mm-hmm. together, they kept planting corn year after year, after year. Yep. What have you seen in the plains when it comes to that kind of energy? And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like it's worked very well, but what have you seen?
Well, I think it hasn't worked very well for the simple reasons you said. I think once we, again, this is interesting. Maybe the corn-based ethanol was the perfect illustration of what happens when you reduce a long-standing ecological relationship, one part of that relationship, the three sisters, to a resource. A resource you've got to maximize, you've got to extract, and what we find out is it doesn't have very good consequences. It doesn't have good consequences for the land, for the farmers, and then we turn out that, you know, from an environmental standpoint, it's far from the best choice we mm-hmm. have.
Yeah.
And we start growing. What does that mean when we grow? We start growing food, again, for our machines when we have so much starvation on the planet.
Yeah,
that's kind of an interesting idea. Let's grow more corn, not for people, but for our machines.
And interestingly enough, and not surprisingly, it impacted food prices around the world. And so
it did.
Yeah,
it did.
Yeah. So, well, I wish we could have another hour with you, Dr. Wildcat, but we got about a minute left. Let us know what. Give us a quick little idea about what you're going to hear. What we're going to hear 8 p.m. on Thursday night in the Albright Auditorium.
Well, what I'm going to ask people to do is let's take a moment to pause and say, let's try to enact some imagination, some intelligence, and contrary to a popular commercial that some people will recognize where we're asked to help a corporation build a smarter planet, I would suggest the planet's not dumb. The planet's never been dumb, and it's trying to teach us something right now, and it's time for us to pay attention.
Dr. Daniel Wildcat's book is called Red Alert, Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge. He's a member of the Muscogee Nation of Oklahoma, and he is at Hobart and William Smith for the week. It's been fun, Dr. Wildcat. And by the way, Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to say that kids are born scientists. I also think kids are born naturalists. My son will tell me, he's two, if I'm working on my cell phone, he'll say, Daddy, put it in the pocket. Go outside. And I know
Great advice.
I know you would appreciate that.
Listen to the children. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time this hour, and we'll see you Thursday night at Hobart William Smith's Albright Auditorium. Thank you, Dr. Wildcat.
Thank you.
Dr. Daniel Wildcat for the hour. And, you know, as Anthony, the caller earlier in the hour, told us, you know, he might have some issues with some of the ideas. It's about opening our minds and not necessarily changing your mind every day, but we're thinking about a lot of different angles here, and that's what we try to do and have good conversation here on Connections. So thanks for Dr. Wildcat. Take a quick break, come right back, and talk diversity in the workforce and how we are trying to empower ourselves next on Connections on member-supported public radio.